Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. So, Sterling, great to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Welcome.
Thank you, Guy. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I have had quite a lot of anticipation for this. So when I see somebody and they go across my kind of social media stream and then I start to dig in, you know, I either kind of, or I go, ooh, and I start to get excited.
So well, let's hope we can live up to that.
Exactly, you see. So I don't know what living up to hoo-hoo is, but we're about to find out.
That's
so
right.
On that note, so Sterling, I know who you are. Just introduce yourself to the audience so they've got a sense of you.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'm Sterling Hawkins. I'm a writer, researcher, and keynote speaker all around how do you unleash human potential inside individual leaders and more importantly for the work that I do inside of companies. And when you do that, the leaders and the companies they're running become unstoppable.
Now, big statement.
Yeah.
And to back up a big statement like that, you've got to have had a set of experiences in life that give you a foundation and a platform to stand off. So
certainly,
you're either saying it from an academic position, I've done nothing, but I've read a lot, or you're doing it from a position of, well, I've read stuff, but I've had my moments.
Yeah. So yeah, I've had some moments, not necessarily good ones either. You know, a lot of people that have a platform similar to my own have, you know, taken a company public at some astronomical valuation or performed some incredible human feat, like climbing Mount Everest on their hands and knees. But how I got into this was by a massive, massive failure, professionally and, you know, certainly personally as well. What happened, Guy,
well,
and I think you know some.
Life. Yep.
Yeah, well, I started a company right out of college, co-founded with my dad, actually, and we sold it to a group in Silicon Valley where it became part of Apple Pay before Apple Pay. And it worked very similar. It was a little fingerprint sensor set next to the credit card terminal. So you didn't even need your phone for this thing. You put your finger down, credit cards come up, loyalty came up, whatever was in your electronic wallet, just like Apple Pay. And investors saw this thing and they're like, yes, this is the future. And so we raised over $550 million US dollars, multi-billion dollar valuation. It was insane. I mean, there's a fair number of companies in that stratosphere these days. This is like early 2000s, and we were one of two startups that had that kind of valuation. And I'll tell you, I thought I had this whole thing figured out. I thought I had life figured out, business figured out. I'm ready to buy a private island, maybe a jet. I'm like, I am the next Richard Branson. Here we go. Let's launch. But it didn't work out that way. You know, due to a whole variety of reasons, leadership failures, I would categorize them as. When the housing market collapsed, our investment dried up, and we didn't have enough organic growth to sustain it. So the entire thing ended up going bankrupt. Half a billion US dollars gone. And, you know, it was such a collapse. Not only of the company, but because my whole identity was tied up in it, I crashed as well. And I started playing out this bad country song where not only do I no longer have a job, but eventually I run out of cash. I go from this big, beautiful penthouse in downtown San Francisco, looking right out over the Bay Bridge, like just an iconic place, to the spare bedroom in my parents' house, which is not a good look in your 30s, I can tell you that. And just to make sure I was firmly grounded in rock bottom, my girlfriend broke up with me. It was like one thing after another. I'm hitting every single beat. And, you know, that first night, I'll never forget. I'm laying in bed, staring at the ceiling. I've got boxes around me and a couple of suitcases that I brought. And I didn't know if I could or even if I wanted to go on. And I told myself, I made this like very personal declaration that night. I said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to confront this failure. I'm going to confront the unknown. I'm going to confront this discomfort in my life with three words that become very important to me. No matter what. and just putting one foot in the front of the other. And things as simple as, I'm going to get out of bed at 7 a.m. tomorrow no matter what. I'm going to call this creditor. I was in about six figures of personal debt. I'm going to call this creditor tomorrow no matter what. And that was the beginning of building myself back.
And, you know, I was speaking to another guest on a little bit earlier this morning.
Yeah.
And he was involved in, he's an eye surgeon. And he was involved in stuff in Afghanistan because that's where he was from. And we were just talking about how the worst thing that can happen to you sometimes can feel like a first world problem versus a third world problem, right? You don't live in the Congo and you're not waking up fearful of death,
right?
So we do know that, you know, our problem is a first world problem. It's all horrible, but I'm gonna get fed and there is a house I'm living in, and but actually it still doesn't stop the pain
because it's
so personal to you.
Well, and I think importantly is that pain is relative, right? You can't be sadder than sad. So your maximum experience of sad or maximum experience of anxiety may be triggered by different circumstances. You may literally have your life at risk versus seemingly maybe only your ego at risk. But the human experience is the same. And, you know, I think individually has to be acknowledged as such to confront it in a way to give you a foundation to stand on to grow.
So from that position then of
no
matter what, which is a position of almost being at the bottom of a well and looking up and going, I don't know how I'm going to get out of it. And I'm not even going to say I've got a plan today, but I'm getting out of this. So a commitment to the commitment, you know, I've got a commitment to the commitment, you know, I'll figure it out from there. So in the time that we've got, so what are the stepping stones? Where did you... You know, you found those creditors. There's almost dealing with being in the red, and then there's that. You know, but then there's moving into the light. And where did you know? Did you start to formulate a vision? Was it a do you know what? I don't know where this is going to go, but I'm just going to start this. Or no, I just went big straight away. Or how is it? Yeah, where did the transition come?
Yeah, well, you know, there were definitely weeks of survival in there where I'm just like, you know, get out of bed, Sterling, go to the gym, make the phone calls, like just one foot in front of the other, do what you know you need to do. And one day I'm sitting at the computer, just, you know, kind of poking around social media, catching up on emails, that kind of thing. And this thing my mom used to say when I was a kid popped into my head. And she's always had all these phenomenal sayings, but the saying that popped into my head was, the way out is through. Have you heard that one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
It's actually Robert Frost quote. To me, it'll always be my mom. And it means to achieve the results that we want, to transform our circumstances, whatever it might be, we have to go through whatever's in our way. We can't go around it. We can't avoid it. We can't survive it. And I'm sitting at my computer and I say, all right, let's test this thing out. And right then, it, almost like the clouds opened up or the heavens parted or whatever it was, my email dings and it's this kind of a junk email from a conference in Singapore. I'm sure they invited thousands upon thousands of people to join as attendees. And funny enough, the thing that scared me most at the time was speaking in public. Like deathly afraid of it. It wasn't always the case, but something about the collapse of that company and my whole identity being tied up in it, I, you know, withdrew from friends, withdrew from more extended family. Like I really pulled in because I didn't know who I was anymore. And when I didn't know who I was, I was scared to stand on any stage or speak to anybody. You know, it was a dark spot. And so I hit reply on that email. Like, didn't, like, press apply to speak or anything. I just hit reply, why don't you have me speak, Best Sterling? If the way out's through, I'm going to go through the thing that has scared me the most. And I don't know, maybe it's because I didn't have anything to lose and a lot to gain, but I end up emailing with the conference director. We talk on the phone. I share a little bit about what I want to share on the stage. And I kid you not, he brought me in as the keynote speaker of his conference. And as I'm signing the legal agreement, I'm thinking to myself, Sterling, you're insane. Not only do you have no speaking credentials, no website, no speaker reel, but what you're going to talk about is the biggest failure of your life. This is nuts. What are you doing? But I committed when I signed that agreement. And the next 3 or 4 months leading up to that talk, I was obsessed with it. I practiced constantly. My poor sister, she was right out of college, and I recruited her. And I'm like, listen, I need you to help me. And so she would be my audience. She helped me put the slides together and everything else. And the day finally came. And I don't know, even with all the practice, I was still terrified to stand on that stage. I remember sitting in the audience, like, sweating. My face is red. My hands are clammy. The room's starting to spin. You ever been there when you get really nervous? And, you know, they call me up to the stage, and it is a really good thing I practiced, because I think I blacked out when I gave that talk. Like, I don't remember how those 35 minutes went. And I get off the stage, and guy, I thought I bombed. Like, I was covering my eyes and didn't want to see anybody. And the conference director, of course, is making a beeline for me, and I'm like, oh, no. Like, please don't ask for the money back. Like, just let me get out of here alive. And he looks me in the eyes. I'll never forget it. He goes, Sterling, that's the greatest talk I've seen in my 17 years of doing this job.
Boom.
I was stunned. And I'll tell you, to this day, I don't think he was in the same talk that I gave. Like, I'm convinced that he just wanted to say something nice to me as a speaker. But what he did is he went on to put me in touch with all of his conference director friends, and I had the beginnings of a speaking career on my hands, which is primarily what I do today. And, you know, it turns out my mom was right. The way out is through. You just have to commit to going through no matter what.
I love that. On a completely different level, I did a TEDx.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the sort of the localized TED talks.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done one. They're great.
Practicing to the point of oblivion.
Yeah.
And then stepping out, and they said, oh, we haven't got a timer or a clock.
Oh,
brilliant. But don't go over. And then the lights went on and I couldn't see anybody.
Yeah.
The way they'd done it. It was just hilarious. And then I remember finishing.
Hmm.
And I don't remember from the moment I said, hello, to when I went, thank you. I've watched the video, but I have no memory of it since. And it's like, somebody went, that was really good. I went, I'll have to take your word for it, because I have no memory of what just happened out there.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't happen to me anymore, but because it was six cap, three, four cap, whatever it was, and it was all light, and you couldn't go back, and there was an audio. I mean, you know, you've got to do the first one for the second one not to be a problem.
Sure.
But that just makes me smile, because I, at a different level, but I get it. Yeah,
but again, you know, similar experiences, and whether you're doing it on a TEDx stage, or you're doing it on a stage in Singapore, or doing it in front of giving a toast at a wedding for friends and family. Like, it's the human experience that there is to overcome. And I think when you commit to the things that maybe scare you the most, not at a superficial level, but viscerally, and you rise up or find the courage inside of yourself to go through it, no matter how it goes, no matter what we're facing, I think the potential inside of us is always greater than what's in front of us. And it's just a matter of unleashing it. It just takes a lot of courage to do so.
So I want, would you hold up the book for me?
Of course.
Because I love the front cover, Hunting Discomfort.
Thanks.
A is brilliant, yeah. And I love the look of it. So we'll make sure everybody knows about it. But just, you know, how to get breakthrough results in life and business. It doesn't say hashtag no matter what, but it says hashtag no matter what behind you, but no matter what.
That's right. So
give me a sense of, somebody's listening to this episode and, you know, there's books galore in the world, and why would I go, yeah, that's something it feels like I should get.
Yeah.
Who do you think should read it? Who do you think, do you know what, if you read this, this is the value I believe it's going to bring to you.
Yeah. Well, so I got in a little fight with the publisher about including a hashtag in the subtitle or not. and they won out. They're like, you know what? For SEO and Amazon and all the places you're going to sell it, like, you just can't do a hashtag. So So they won that. But no matter what, has become a hashtag. You know, that very personal mantra I said to myself, gosh, coming up on a decade ago, has become a movement of leaders from around the world. And what the book's about, and you know why this has become so powerful, is because it reorients our relationship to the unknown and all the discomfort that goes with it. You know, unconsciously, many of us are living our lives, running our businesses, constructing our experiences day in and day out, unconsciously avoiding discomfort. And it turns out that discomfort, finding that discomfort and then going through it, is actually a divining rod to find the very results that you're looking for. Whatever it is, you know, more money, a greater business, even more joy and happiness, or better relationship connections with the people that you're closest to. All of that is on the other side of discomfort. And I found some cornerstone research at the University of Michigan. And they were studying, of all things, discomfort. I'm like, I got to read about this study. Like, it's so on brand for me. I got to understand how this works. And they were looking at physical discomfort. You know, you break an arm or something. Emotional discomfort, somebody loses a job or breaks up with a significant other, something along those lines. Mental discomfort. And as people are going through this discomfort, they're scanning their brains. They're looking at their body. And what they found blew me away. No matter what kind of discomfort somebody was experiencing, physical, mental, emotional, arguably spiritual, although that wasn't in the study, no matter what kind of discomfort they were facing, their body and brain processed it almost identically. So much so that they found that you can take acetaminophen to make your emotional pain feel better. I had no idea. I don't suggest that for anybody, by the way. That's not like a life hack. Nobody should be taking Tylenol when they don't feel very good about something. But building on that research, we took the next step to say, okay, well, if how we experience discomfort is the same everywhere, we can build the capacity to handle discomfort anywhere. It's a muscle you can build. Everybody knows if you want to build your biceps, you go to the gym. Well, if you want to build your resiliency, your ability to grow, your ability to create breakthrough results for yourself personally or professionally, well, you hunt discomfort. And that's really what the book is about. Now, most importantly, the biggest thing that I hear when I talk about discomfort is people will tell me, Sterling, you got to look at my relationships, my bank account, my business problems. I have all this discomfort in my life. I don't need to hunt discomfort. And my answer is always the same. Oh, you mean you're living with discomfort? You're not hunting it. The five steps inside of this book, and we can get into it here, of course, but the five steps inside the book are not designed to make you more and more uncomfortable. They're designed to build your discomfort muscle to ultimately free you from discomfort so you never experience it again. And when you free yourself at higher and higher levels, your results just get exponentially greater every step of the way. Does that make sense?
It does, and there's a lot going on in what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I can feel that we're touching the tip of an iceberg around it's more than just resilience, but there is this idea of also anti-fragile.
Oh yeah, you've come across,
yeah, which is this kind of space of what you're talking about is hunting discomfort will create an anti-fragility. You know, they'll create it'll take you to a place where actually almost like a behavioral conditioning kind of thing, if you expose yourself and face into it and step into it. And I love that, you know, I love that phrase, you know, your success is at the other side of discomfort.
It's the only thing in the way.
As an individual, as a team, as an organization, going, what do we fear? What are we not being real about? What are the conversations we're not having, etc., etc.? The more we go through that, then of course the better we get at it. Easy thing to say, isn't it? It's like if you go to the gym, you're going to get fitter. Yeah, then why aren't we all doing it?
Right.
Intellectually, the intellectualization of it is one thing, right?
Right.
The mechanic to do it. So I am interested in the stepping stones are there, but do you get into that almost being a, the book itself is a trigger for its own motivation?
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of that, that, you know, is that part of that process for you?
Very much so. And, you know, similarly, just because you go to the gym doesn't guarantee you that you're going to get bigger or be fitter. You know, you have to be eating the right things outside of the gym. You need to be doing the right exercises in the gym. You need to be, you know, maybe working with an expert to help you understand what to do and where to go and how often to be working out. And it's much the same with discomfort. Just experiencing it isn't enough. You've got to work with it in a very specific way. And the first step for any person or any company that, I would work with is to look at how they're viewing reality. And reality around one of three spaces: who they see themselves to be, their identity, how they see others, specific others or others in general, and how they see the world. And, you know, when we look at reality, we're actually looking at it through a lens of belief. I've found that beliefs, perspectives work a lot like lenses in glasses, of course. And if I were to wear your glasses, Guy, they would make me see worse, presumably. You wearing your glasses, you see better with them. So that's one function of a belief or a perspective, is it changes what you see, the quality at which you see it. The second aspect of it, which is equally, if not more important, is that I would be willing to bet oftentimes you're not taking your glasses off on a regular basis and assessing the lenses. You know, you might go to an eye doctor every couple of years and they'll check your prescription, but we don't often take our glasses off and say, hey, is this still the right lens to be wearing? And beliefs work the same way. We often don't step back to say, hey, is how I'm viewing myself or this other person or the world, is that the right way to see it? And I would say if you don't have the results that you want in a particular area, it's not, right? It's the belief you have about who you are, who another is, how the world works, something in that vein isn't aligned with reality to give you the result that you want. Now, the trickier part, again, it's like the intellectual versus the actually doing it. Giving up who you think you are is an incredibly difficult process. And it starts with, you know, like we've been talking about, pushing through the things that are uncomfortable. One of my favorite ways to do it, and there's a bunch of ideas in the book, but my favorite way to change who you are, let go of who you think you are, and shift how you see reality is to do something really, really hard. You know, I was forced into something really, really hard. You know, when that company fell apart, I wouldn't have picked that for the life of me. But now understanding how discomfort works, you know, I'll push myself to cycle across the Rockies or run a marathon in the Sahara, whatever it is. Like, I'll look for things that push me past that comfort zone because I know every time that I do it or maybe even just attempt it, the view of who I see myself to be is different. And when the view or the belief changes, your actions will naturally be different. And then ultimately, it will give rise to a new result.
So there's something really powerful there about exposing yourself. It's about seeing vulnerability as not weakness, but actually not exposing yourself in a manner of danger, but exposing yourself with calculation to levels of challenges, be it a conversation, be it reflection, be it whatever it be, it might be education, might be physical, might be emotional, to say, how do you step forward? You can step forward incrementally through life experience, i.e. wait for life to give you the experiences, deal with them, and then you will incrementally move forward. But if you want to shift, you have to locate things outside of the incremental. So you have these experiences that almost like a water shock. You'll survive it, but then at least you'll know what it feels like and you can decide whether or not you want to do it again, but it'll change you. It'll do something to you.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It fundamentally changes who you are. And I think the mistake that a lot of people and companies make especially is they resign themselves to the incremental. oh, it's only reasonable to grow 5% this year or 15% this year. You know, we can't grow in these ways because of competition doing this or the pandemic, right? There's a long list of very logical reasons. And I'm not saying those things aren't true. I'm saying that they're simply one way to view the set of circumstances that are in front of you. You know, when you want to break through a level of discomfort, I think there's two components of it. The first is, you know, as you say, like exposure therapy. And it works very similar to what they do in working with people that have phobias. You know, if you've got a phobia of a dog, well, first you might talk about that phobia, and then they'll show you a picture of the dog, and then maybe they'll put a dog across the room, and then you get closer and closer and closer to the dog, continually exposing yourself to it and realizing, oh, the dog's not that scary after all. And we can do the same thing. You know, I shared one of my fears, biggest fears was speaking in public. And, you know, I took a big jump, admittedly. But somebody could start out maybe speaking at their family dinner table. And then you speak to a conference room of people. And then you join Toastmasters and speak to them. And you gradually raise the bar. And when you change the bar from a discomfort standpoint, you radically alter your results. So that's one piece of it. The second is getting to the root of that discomfort. And that's important because oftentimes people have miscalibrated their, let's call it discomfort emotions. And what I mean by that is that discomfort is oftentimes not aligned with real danger. You know, I can go skydiving and that feels very uncomfortable, feels very scary. But ultimately, driving to the place where I'm going to skydive is really more dangerous. My discomfort's not aligned with the danger. So as you can dig into that discomfort and understand where it actually started, you know, did it start when you were 5 years old, maybe when you were 15, 20? Like what happened when that started? And by digging into that and understanding the root of where that discomfort started, it starts to loosen its hold on you and you're ultimately free from it. So those two aspects of exposing yourself to it and getting to the root of it is really what we mean by hunting discomfort, like getting rid of it once and for all so you don't have it standing in your way.
I like this. I think it's... Good.
I was hoping you'd say that. Good. Yeah. Are we living up to the Instagram hype?
That'd be fantastic, wouldn't it? I've listened to this and this is crap. I don't believe it. No, it resonates. And I think it resonates because... You know, I work with leaders, I work with execs and senior teams and talent that are coming through in organizations. So it's called Leadership Bites, the episode of the podcast, because you know, that's where I'm aiming at. And I can see how one of the things that I do talk about, if things are inherently true, they're usually true everywhere.
They would have to be.
If you're going to do feedback, then giving feedback to your kids, to your partner, to yourself, to your boss, the mechanism's the same.
Yeah.
And the motivation to do it, you know, if you've got it right, should be to be of value and to add value. So these things are inherently true. Now, you may have different levels of anxiety or fear in relationship to hierarchy or, no, I'm happy to give my boss, but try and give my other half feedback. Well, good luck with that. You know, we've all got the truths that we're dealing with, right? But right. I think what I'm interested in is the methodology and the mechanism intellectually. That's normally not difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. You know, how would I do it? Well, here's, you know, it's like getting fit, you know, right foot, left foot, continue until you're tired and then do that three times a week. It's not particularly tricky. But what I think is what you're really hitting on here is there's got to be a discussion about your relationship with your own identity, about who you say you are.
Right.
Because if you're going to say you've got a problem with it and you're looking to be cured, i.e. I want to read a book and I want it to cure me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. But if you want to read a book that'll challenge you with something that by definition it says hunting discomfort on the front. Not let me make your life easier.
Right. It doesn't say let me teach you about discomfort.
Right, exactly. So it's actually what I like is that upfront kind of, if you really, how real is your desire? Yeah. How, you know, how, because if it's, you know, everything's got to be immediate and this general, you know, I just want it to be easy. You know, you see the things on Facebook and all that lot, you know, work from one day a week on the beach and be a millionaire.
Right.
Mate, if you know, come on, it's hard work. So this isn't offering easy, is it? It's offering hard.
Yeah.
But hard with a sense of purpose, that when you attach that purpose to the mechanism,
yeah,
it becomes magnified in its tolerability because you're doing it for reasons that are inherently in you and for, right, a place you want to get to. So this, yeah, feels, if I'm understanding you correctly, it feels, you know, very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's, well, first let me back up. That's the reason in the book there's a whole bunch of exercises at the end of each chapter to say, okay, you know, you've read about this, you've learned this, here's the case studies, here's the brain science. Now, here's how you grab onto it and go do it. You know, one of the things I, right, I just shared, go do something really hard, but you do, nice, have to commit. And that commitment, yeah, you say, is critically important. Self-accountability doesn't work for something like this. I think self-accountability is fantastic. It's important. But if I'm running 5 days a week already, the likelihood I'm going to be able to continue doing that, just being self-accountable, is very, very high. But when you're transforming your identity, you're going into the depths of who you are and digging out greater potential, you require somebody on the outside of you to hold you true. Because in that experience, everything in your mind is going to tell you why you can't, why you shouldn't, why it's dangerous, why it's jeopardizing your family, your career. It's the stupidest thing in the world. And ultimately, that's your mind doing something very important, trying to keep you safe, which it will, but it's ultimately suppressing your potential. So somebody outside holding you accountable to some of these things is really important. I think most people have a sense that they have greater potential than they're bringing to the table. And I would say that that's true for everybody, whether they think that or not. There's always greater potential inside of you. The thing standing between you and that greater potential is one thing and one thing alone: discomfort and the willingness to face it. You know, a lot of times I hear some of the negative connotations of discomfort, like fear, anger, grief, embarrassment, shame, like really heavy things. Like, well, we don't want those things. And that's fine. But they're part of you. And when you're denying discomfort of any sort, you're denying part of yourself. And you need that part of you to reach greater potential.
So do you advocate within this process having, would you say it's a coach, it's a mentor, it's a counsel, it's just a friend who holds you to account? It could be a mate who you just say, listen, every week I just want you to ask me this question. Or how do you see that outside of self?
Yeah, well, there's a number of ways to commit. One of my favorites and probably the easiest is to just say it to somebody that's going to hold you accountable, like seriously accountable. I call it building a street gang in the book. I don't say like build a network of friends. I'm not talking about a personal board of directors. I'm talking about a street gang that is going to go toe to toe with you and is committed not to your identity, not to who you think you are, not to your comfort level. They're committed to your potential, and it has teeth. And when you find that person and you say to them, here's what I'm committed to do. I'm going to do this speech. I'm going to start this company, whatever it is. Then, yeah, you need to set up checkpoints to say, I'm going to accomplish something specific on a specific day at a specific time, and we're going to meet, we're going to talk on Zoom, we're going to have coffee, whatever that checkpoint is, and we're going to chat about it. Research shows that when you're personally accountable like that, you're 95% more likely to reach your goal. 95%. I mean, when I saw that, I was like, wait a minute. So if I want to achieve anything, I've got a really, really, really high degree of likelihood to achieve that if I'm just personally accountable. So where can I find that accountability for the most important things to me? And growth is number one on the list.
So that 95% is when you're contracting with somebody, giving them permission, asking them to hold you to account.
That's right. Specific and time, it's gotta be, specific day, specific deliverable. Maybe it's not like a legal contract, but it's certainly a verbal agreement to say, here's what's going to happen on this day at this time.
And it's giving them a permission and setting an expectation then that, you know, we can't laugh it off. I can't, you know, if it's going to be real, you've got to be disappointed with me. You've got to challenge me. You've got, in fact, here are the four questions I want you to ask me if I say I haven't done it, you know,
exactly,
et cetera, whatever it is.
Yeah, that, and maybe, says, maybe not disappointment. But a conversation about what went wrong. Because usually where those conversations go, if they're not powerful, they'll go down the path of talking about all the reasons why you didn't achieve something. And those reasons may be very true. But as Tony Robbins says, and I love this quote from him, it's not a question of your resources. It's a question of your resourcefulness. So, you know, given all those reasons, given the circumstances, given the challenges you faced, like, where could you have thought bigger, gone harder, been more creative? Because that's the growth that you're looking to find. You know, doing things exactly how everybody has done them, like, best practices make me laugh all the time because I'm like, oh, that's just how somebody's done it already. If you want breakthrough results, you got to kind of look into your heart, look into your spirit and say, okay, where can I unleash some creativity, determination inside of myself to get after this goal, even if I have all of these reasons why it's impossible to achieve? Quote unquote impossible, of course.
Are you able, without going into, because, you know, people, we want people to read the book and not sure. have a training session on here, but just you sort of spoke about those steps. Are you able just to share what the headings are, just to give people an appetizer around what those might be?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the first step, and we've talked about it, is getting rid of, or at least addressing, your limited beliefs and expanding your reality. And the best way to do that is to take the second step and commit to something. Like, commit so deeply there's no going back. I call it get a tattoo. And it's the antidote to self-doubt, by the way. So if you've got a lot of self-doubt telling you you can't, you shouldn't, you're not cut out for it, you're too old, you don't have enough money, when you start committing in small ways, maybe at first, and then in larger and larger ways, you actually build a courage to overcome that self-doubt. I'm not saying that voice in your head will stop, but I will say that you will overcome it by getting that proverbial tattoo, by committing in a way where there's no going back. The third step is build a street gang. You know, surround yourself with people that are going to hold you to your potential, what you said you wanted to do. And there's a couple important aspects. You know, accountability is maybe the most important in that. But the other roles inside of the street gang is you need some level of mentorship. You need somebody to kind of show you at least directionally where you're headed, give you some specialized knowledge. You need some kind of inspiration, some purpose inside of you. Now, that might be a person, it might be a thing, it might be an idea, but some inspiration to carry you forward, especially through the hardest times. And you need love. You know, as you're going through these really difficult circumstances, you need somebody, again, outside of yourself, to love you exactly as you are. For me, it was my mom and my sister that got me through those hardest times. Doesn't matter who they are, how you're related to them, but somebody that unconditionally accepts you as you're going through this. So those are the main aspects of the street gang. You know, the fourth step is, well, how do you overcome challenges? Because we all have them. And at the end of the day, sometimes you don't have enough money to do certain things, or you don't have enough time. Those are very real. But how do you use those challenges as the door to breakthrough results? It's a very Stoic philosophy of the obstacle is the way. And there's a whole variety of ways to understand your situation in a new way to create a breakthrough result. One of my favorite stories from the book is about a restaurant that during the pandemic started to look for how they could use their challenges to create new results. And so, for example, they had a problem getting all their supplies they needed for the menu. So they scrapped the menu and created like special evening specialty courses like a spa night or a Japanese beef night. And so they used all these problems, and they actually created more business than even when their doors were open pre-pandemic. You know, thankfully they're open again, but they're growing during the pandemic in one of the most challenged markets globally at a time when restaurants are losing billions of dollars. So, you know, it's never a question of the circumstances. It's a question of how you use those challenges and flip them to create a breakthrough result. And then the fifth step, and I'll pass it back to you because I know I'm talking a lot here. It may be the most important. If the way out is through, the way through is surrender. And the fifth step is surrender. Like, how do you accept things exactly as they are and exactly as they're not? Carl Jung, famous psychologist, I'm sure you're familiar with all of your listeners, right? He said, we cannot change anything until we accept it. Condemnation does not liberate. It oppresses. So as you're condemning the situation you're in, or you're not the right kind of person, or you don't have enough money, or you don't have enough time, the more that you're condemning those things, the more you're sentencing yourself to those kinds of results. And when you surrender, you open yourself to them, it frees you to reach that greater potential. So those are the five steps. How do we do?
I mean, each one is a... It's own topic. And its own
each one of them is like the tip of an iceberg, yeah, you know?
Exactly. So I'm just paying attention to time and being alert to my next question, which could send me down a rabbit warren of you going, yeah, I'm not now your personal coach guy, let's be clear. Can I just pick up on one, which is love. It's an interesting word. So I don't want to necessarily get into the mechanics of that, but be it love, be it support, be it somebody who has a sense of care and interest in you, I think is what I'm hearing.
Yeah,
and I do remember a comedian saying, you know, I'm trying to be the person my dog thinks I am.
Yeah,
which is that kind of, you know, somebody who you want to, whose opinion is important to you, maybe, because otherwise, why would you listen? And yeah. I this is not an ambush question, but I just think for some people who maybe have isolated themselves. Mm-hmm. Or just don't have inherently the bigger framework that is around them.
Yeah.
Is in itself part of that stepping stone? Maybe, you know, that will be part of your process. You are going to have to engage with the world. You're going to have even if it's your family and they love you, that's an easy one, right?
Right.
Well, maybe it's easier unless you've upset them. But you may have to reach out to a stranger or somebody that you do know that you may not see as a friend and try and find a way of engaging them in being part of your process, even if they're not coming from a place of love. Am I talking correctly here? Because how do I engage when I don't necessarily have that instant support mechanism?
Yeah, well, a couple things about that. The first is it is challenging in and of itself because it's going to open up the discomfort or the fear of exposure. You know, somebody seeing who you really are and, you know, all the actions, all the things you've done great, all the things you've messed up on, the things you've done inside of relationships. And having somebody that accepts that doesn't mean that you don't get into fights. It doesn't mean that they like everything that you do, but it does mean that they've opened themselves to accept all of you, or at least committed to accepting all of you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the traditional view of love, of like, oh, I love my wife, or I love my dad, or whatever it is, right? It's a much greater sense, a much more profound kind of love, of acceptance that's beyond any kind of circumstances, any kind of situations that you might be in, to really accept who you are. And I do think that may be the discomfort that you've got to overcome. Like, that fear of exposure is a really, really big one. And in talking to friends, talking to family, finding people online, like, it, there aren't really any rules around where you find this person. And finding them may be part of your hunting discomfort as well. And so it's really building that community over time. Mm. It's not, I'm going to check that off the list. I built my street gang. It's, okay, I'm going to be here, God willing, for some significant period of time. I have some years ahead of me. How can I start to build and cultivate the right kinds of relationships around me to support the growth that I'm committed to?
And, you know, when I work with senior teams who have, you know, you take 10 human beings, put them together and say, you know, get on with it, then there's always a distribution curve of, I really quite like you, I'm ambivalent about you, and, you know, you're not my cup of tea at all.
Right.
But there might be, I think there is something here about, I'm not using this vocabulary, but I notice that, you know, I will now be referencing your book because after I've read it, is that kind of point of this team needs to hunt discomfort. This team, and it's not the camaraderie, the connection, the you know, whatever it is the sharing, is sharing the journey.
Right.
I.e., we may have been thrown together, but if we're all on this ship, and we've got to get it to that port, it makes bedfellows of us, right?
Because, exactly.
You know, we've all got to cross the line together, or none of us cross the line. So I think that that agreement to share the experience, to be that support space, has nothing to do with friendship necessarily.
Maybe not.
But a commitment to it, which will probably then create respect, will probably then create relationships, and probably create friendships, but through the commitment to the mechanism and to the process, if I've heard you correctly.
That's exactly right. You know, I do a lot of work with high-performing teams. And the thing, again, the only thing that's between them and higher performance is discomfort, digging deeper into their own personal discomforts, and ideally doing that as a team. And it will create bonds that people will have for life. You know, I think there's two things that bond people. One is time. You know, if you're around somebody long enough, you're going to become friends or closer, at least to get to know each other better. But the other is trauma or discomfort or challenging times. You know, we don't know each other all that well, Guy, but I guarantee you if we jumped out of a plane together, we'd be best friends when we hit the ground.
By the time we got to the bottom, right?
Yeah. Right. Right. And as you create these experiences with anybody, any group, by the way, you could do it with your friendship group, you could do it with your family, you could do it with your board, could do it with your leadership team. As you unpack some of these personal discomforts, it will bond you in profound ways. And as you're committed to overall growth, not necessarily the person, but that person's growth, I think you'll find that even the people that maybe rub you the wrong way, you find an appreciation for who they are somewhere in there.
Yeah, I love this. Okay, so listen, Sterling, I hate to do this because, and I think I've said this on my last four or five episodes with some great people, which is, I want to go for the next week.
But, you know, we'll do it again sometime.
You know, that might be... That might be true. This is a topic and I love it. And I think it's, as I say, and I think this is the catalyst. Hunting discomfort, I think, is, you know, I don't always say I'm going to read somebody's book when they come on the show, because obviously I'll be reading books for the next 40 years. But this is, this has been a catalyst for me to go, this is one that is worth me looking at and reading. So I'm pleased that that's happened, because I don't normally have that excitement to do so.
Thank you. So, well, you'll have to let me know what you think when you get through it.
You know, I will definitely. I'll do an Amazon review as well.
That would be much appreciated.
Well, I've met Sterling, and I'd like to say so sterlinghawkins.com is the website I'm looking at, and I'll put that in the links. Is there anywhere else people should connect with you, or is that the first go-to place, Sterling?
Yeah, sterlinghawkins.com has all the information about me. It's got all of our social links, although Sterling Hawkins is fairly Googleable, so I think most people would be able to find me. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, a whole bunch of other places. And if you're looking for information on the book specifically, that would be huntingdiscomfort.com.
Okay, so huntingdiscomfort.com specifically for the book, Sterling Hawkins to connect with.com for Sterling himself. And from me to you, I'm going to get you to stay on for a few moments afterwards just to make sure everything's working as it should be. But just, you know, thank you so much for creating this space and this time. It has been a genuine joy for me, and I'm sure for listeners as well. So thank you for that.
It's my pleasure. Appreciate you having me on.
That's it, so I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness, and changing culture. Oh, and of course you can buy my book Living Brave Leadership on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.